recording.
You're listening to
Source News
on 4EB Community Radio, presented by Griffith University students.
Welcome to the Source News. I'm Amala.
And I'm Kian.
Delivered to you straight from our Brisbane studios on Turrbal and Yagra land, our show today takes a focus on efforts of environmental sustainability.
You are going to want to stick around as we have some very interesting stories lined up. To begin, we look at the Cleveland community's harrowing fight to protect their endangered wetlands and wildlife from development.
Moving broader, we'll investigate the growing land management system of permaculture.
Following that, locals standing up against the government, why the Kalula residents are protesting the construction of eco-cabins in their national park.
Lastly, we'll explore the future of food production, cultured meat.
Before delving into these exciting stories, let's take a brief look at the weather.
Good news! Brisbane today is mostly sunny with a 5% chance of rain. The sun will continue to shine all the way through till Thursday, when it will begin to get cloudy, eventually leading to light rains on Saturday. The temperature today will vary between a minimum of 5 degrees Celsius and a maximum of 21 degrees Celsius. UV index indicates a moderate 5 and will likely continue with this pattern for the coming days. So dress warm and don't forget to slip, slop, slap.
A grim reality faces locals of Cleveland as they continue to fight the Queensland Government's development of Toondah Harbour. The multi-million dollar development will create a coastal village with the building of new apartments and an upgrade to the ferry facilities. The communities surrounding the harbour fear the government's development will endanger the ecosystem consisting of vulnerable wetlands and wildlife. Imala Imamovic speaks to Cleveland residents, community groups and environmental planners to get the full story.
As Vital Court details of the multi-billion dollar development of the Toondah Harbour on protected wetlands in Moreton Bay remain a secret from the public, locals in the area continue to put pressure on the government to act on preserving the internationally important wetland. The community group Redlands 2030 spokesperson Chris Walker, who is part of the campaign for the document's release, says the project is a symptom of bad governance and lack of transparency to favour property developers.
This is a symptom of a problem. This, you know, proposed Toondah project, it's a symptom of bad governance. And what could we do to do something about it, to try and rectify that? So we thought, rather than being a single issue group, that it would be more effective to be a broad-based group focusing on a range of issues of poor governance, to put pressure on the council to do better, to be more transparent, to be more effective, to be more understanding of what the community wants. So we set up a group called Redlands 2030.
The Queensland Government continues to support the project by identifying the Toondah Harbour as a priority development area, an environmental designation to highlight vitally important infrastructure for the state. Environmental planner and Griffith University lecturer Dr. Natalie Osborne explains the use of the declaration and its ability to sidestep certain planning laws.
It's a planning designation used for infrastructure or major developments that are considered, you know, vitally important for the state. And they're there, they exist under separate legislation. So priority development areas tend to be assessed under the Economic Development Act rather than the Planning Act. And that's so it can circumvent a bunch of the usual processes that would go into assessing the development proposal and expedite it. It sort of concentrates decision-making power with the minister. And so it's just subject to less assessment. There's much narrower opportunities for appeal, much narrower opportunities for any kind of meaningful public consultation. They might still do public consultation, but the idea that that would have any kind of, I guess, the sort of statutory weight that that holds is really diminished when something is designated a priority development area.
While the development has received the green light from the government, what the proposal does not highlight is the possible extinction of migratory shorebirds such as the eastern curlew. The Queensland Wader Study Group, a non-government organisation dedicated to the protection of shorebirds, and its spokesperson Robert Bush, so the species of birds require the Tundra Harbour for its survival.
Okay, so the eastern curlew is the largest migrating shorebird in the world, and it only lives in our flyway, that is between the bottom of the subarctic regions of Russia and Australia. And it breeds up there. They're breeding at the... They're on their way back, actually. They're finished breeding. And it lives on both the east and the western side of Australia. And its population in the last 30 years has declined by about 70%. So the estimate now is that there are only 35,000 of these birds left. The largest flocks of them are here in Moreton Bay. And the, most of those live in the southern part of the bay and live between Dunwich, Wellington Point, and down to the other side of Coochie. So they're in that kind of triangle, and right in the middle of the triangle is this where this development is to take place.
But there are solutions to the all-or-nothing planning approach situated within the Queensland government.
What that kind of glosses over is the idea that it's either that or nothing. And it's like, well, there's probably actually a bunch of other things that we could do, right? If the state wants to get involved in a significant redevelopment of a site, there could be ways to do that in line with ecological and community values that are also positive for the economy, that also contribute to jobs, but not jobs that are based on ecological destruction and social harm. So I think sometimes it gets, I guess, like that idea of the opportunity cost, like what are we not doing because we're developing Tundra Harbour, can sometimes get lost in the mix.
Though, if the government chooses to side with the developers, it may be faced with the inevitable consequences when developing on a protected wetlands.
Just because of how vulnerable that land is, it's like we're pretending that climate change is not a thing that is coming for us all, you know, but that coastline is going to look really different in 20 years' time and 30 years' time from how it does now, but we're just pretending like it's not going to, which is baffling to me.
However, there has been strong local support against the development.
We now have quite a number of people that follow us, that get our newsletters, you know, hopefully we believe we're making some sort of an impact. At least the local council in particular knows that if they do things that are not good or right, then they will get plenty of community attention.
The challenge, however, will be getting enough social movement to create noticeable attention to governments.
You can have a really fantastic, really mobilised community and the government can go ahead and do what it wants anyway. However, if we are going to get something like this stopped, we probably don't stand a chance unless we have a strong social movement behind it.
And for more information and to join the fight, head to redlands2030.com. I'm Imala Imamovic. Don't forget to stay well and stay green.
Imala Imamovic delivering that story to the Source News.
Since COVID-19 started, many people's lives have undergone drastic changes. Some of the most impactful events have been shortages of food and essential items for everyday living. The question is, how can we become more sustainable and prepared for the future? Kian Rone explores food sustainability.
The global COVID-19 pandemic caused severe disruptions for Australian shoppers again this year. With labour shortages causing a breakdown in our food distribution system, seeing many supermarket shelves empty. This crisis is illustrating the potential problems of being dependent on industrial agriculture. PhD student and researcher from the University of Queensland, Christopher Sauer, is currently investigating alternative food distribution systems.
A more productive way of looking at what the COVID, kind of food distribution problems and in some cases crisis, and also with the war in Ukraine, it's actually turning into another food crisis. It just shows that the current kind of global industrial agriculture system is very like dependent on a few key links, that if those key links have any kind of problem, all of a sudden everything would be close to shutting down, you know. So for instance, it's actually quite weak. So If a bunch of truck drivers have COVID-19, you know, then there's literally no supermarket deliveries for huge portions of people.
Despite such a large amount of people being reliant on the current system, there are ways to support more sustainable alternatives.
And what I'm looking at in my research is more an idea of just small alternatives to that global agricultural system. So, for instance, here in Queensland, it might be like if you go to like the Saturday morning market at the West End, you know, I consider those as like little alternatives and almost like little resistances to that industrial agricultural system. And rather than sort of disempowering thought that we need to change everything from the top down, I would say if there's just some way to encourage these small little resistances, like if it's somebody growing their own garden at their house, you know, for some extra vegetables.
Permaculture is an ethical and sustainable system of living which can be integrated in any environment. Permaculture expert Mark Brown from Purple Pear Farms elaborates.
You know, the resources in a city are phenomenal. You know, access to water and to services and those sorts of things, but also to resources. You know, you've got household wastes that are actually incredibly fine for worm farming and composting to build soil. And you can grow food in containers. We've done it in a broccoli box and that sort of thing in the smallest of spaces. But yeah, growing food where it's eaten, as in the city, is a particular aspect of permaculture that has been there from the very beginning.
Mark Brown is an advocate of the permaculture system being implemented into council planning.
What we would like to see, and there is a bit of it going on now, is that councils and that will put aside land, you know, half an acre or something for people to grow their food. And so for every 50 houses that are released on a town plan, you have a half an acre for growing the food. So at least some of the food for those 50 houses is grown right there where it's eaten. And that's truly regenerative. Well, it certainly saves on fossil fuels and that sort of thing.
If you'd like to start practicing more sustainable living, perhaps get a compost bin and start growing some herbs or veggies in your garden. I'm Kian Rone. Stay cool.
That was Kian Rone with a fascinating story on permaculture. Coming up soon, why the Kalula community are fighting the Queensland Government's recent proposal. But first, here's today's news bulletins. Brisbane Airport has been named the most sustainable airport in the world after cutting its net zero emissions deadline by 25 years. Brisbane Airport Corporation CEO Gert Jan de Graaf says the concept is not a new one and has been 12 years in the making. To achieve net zero by 2025, BAC has committed to moving to 100% renewable energy.
British-born Australian actress and singer Olivia Newton-John has passed away peacefully at the age of 73. The Grammy Award winner was best known for her iconic role as Sandy in the 1978 hit movie Grease. Newton-John had a very long battle with cancer, first being diagnosed all the way back in 1993. Today is International Indigenous Peoples Day, a United Nations Day intended to send a message advocating for the protection and promotion of the rights of Indigenous people. The theme for this year is the role of Indigenous women in the preservation and transmission of traditional knowledge. A virtual commemoration was held via Zoom this morning.
Traditional owners and other members of the Kalula community are continuing to protest the Queensland Government's plans to develop eco-cabins within the Kalula National Park. Since announcing their intentions in March 2021, the Government has been met with backlash and resistance from locals. This new take on sustainable tourism will supposedly draw in more hikers, but residents feel it is the Government's attempt to commercialise nature. Brooke Jeffs delivers the report.
This is what the Kalula National Park should sound like. The Queensland Government's recent project is replacing the serene ambiance with machinery. Locals and First Nations people, the Kabi Kabi, are rallying against the Queensland Government's proposal to transform the Kulula National Park into a tourism hotspot. Plans unveiled by the government in March 2021 detail how eco-cabins for hikers will be constructed in five sites throughout the park. Residents fear, though, that these lodges aren't as eco-friendly as advertised. In the government's own report, ecologists warn environmental degradation might occur from development. Senior lecturer from Griffith University's School of Environment and Science, Dr. Ali Chauvinet, explains the impacts.
You start cutting down trees, you affect the sediments, you affect the runoff, you affect the interaction with the water quality. A chain of consequences, short-term and long-term, that might change this ecosystem completely or significantly enough that you might lose biodiversity.
Regardless of expert advice, the government is continuing to arrange building. Convener of Protect Our Parks, Greg Wood, expresses the community outrage and belief that the government is training biodiversity for profit.
Nature now within national parks has to compete with commercial ambitions. I don't want to get crass with my analogies, but if we're going to see commercial investors as a pack of wolves, well, you know, our national parks are sitting there like a flock of sheep.
Despite protests, the government insists neighbourhoods surrounding the park are being adequately consulted. Greg Wood says it is not consultations taking place, but heavily constricted information sessions.
The government did roll out a information sequence of meetings through the month of June 2021, and I went to one of the local meetings here in Rainbow and was instructed by the Department of Environment project managers on what was going to happen. Strongly managed to avoid any interaction. It was quite aggressive towards attempts by the community to challenge or to interrogate some of the plans. It seems in retrospect from what we've been looking at that they don't have all the detail. It's kind of like an ideological shamble.
The government also asserts they are conversing with the First Nations people through the Kabi Kabi Native Title Aboriginal Corporation. Partnering together, the government alleges they are organising park tours led by Native Title applicants that will provide revenue for Kabi people. Kabi lawman Woodbooker says applicants of the Native Title are benefiting, but don't represent or confer with the Kabi Kabi people.
See, the thing is with the applicants, they've set up a corporation which they won't allow any other Kabi people to go into that corporation or have a say. They don't care. All they're worried about is looking after their own families and destroying our sites in the meanwhile. You know, all this comes down to is money. And most of them don't even come from there. They're waka waka.
Some areas identified for lodging are located on sacred sites. Woodbooker maintains that Kabi people desire to preserve these grounds.
We want to preserve this for everybody, not just us, because it's a sensitive area. And then you've got sacred sites that are all over that place, burials that are there, you know, and they just want to sign off on everything and destroy it.
Residents are urging the government to have a proper discussion regarding how the unique and beloved landscape should be used.
An ancillary thing we want is what we haven't had, which is a proper discussion at the community level of what we do need in parks for better local and visitor experiences. There's no public consultation requirements. And the government's actually used that as an excuse for why they haven't done it. Oh, because we don't have to. They don't seem to understand the problem in that statement. Oh, we don't have to, so we won't. Well, you won't next time, will you? When it goes from 10 cabins to 20, we won't hear about it.
Protect Our Parks is imploring others join their cause by signing their online petitions or writing to MPs. This is Brooke Jeffs. Stay sunny.
That was Brooke Jeffs reporting on the Kulula National Park, and this is The Source News.
You're listening to The Source News, local news for your ears.
With the planet's resources exploited to the bone and the looming threat of the changing climate, humanity needs to find alternative sustainable solutions to feed and power communities. In Australia, the IPCC report estimated greenhouse gases from the agricultural and land use sector account for 13% of total emissions, making it the third most polluting department after stationary energy and transport. Plugging renewable energies into the grid could tackle emissions and solve the energy crisis, but when it comes to food, we need new, healthy and sustainable solutions. Innovations such as cultured meat could solve several problems at once, Yakitsi Manolo reporting.
Although it's a concept that seems like fiction, Culture Me could soon become reality, granted public acceptance and regulatory approval. Consisting of meat made out of animal cells replicated in labs, the process doesn't need land for grazing, water consumption, and killing animals. So the use of antibiotics is also not necessary. The ability to replicate meat could feed the planet or even solve world hunger. The COO of Musa Meat, Peter Westreit, one of the pioneers of this exciting innovation based in the Netherlands, explains the technology is already here, but it is not mature yet, and that the main challenges to overcome are global scale production and reducing costs.
I think it's fair to say that most of the companies out there realize that meat production is, or meat demand is going to increase so much that the way it's produced today is not going to be sustainable. There might be differences in if companies expect this technology to replace what they're doing today or to coexist with what they're doing today. And, you know, to be honest, I don't know. It's interesting discussions to have, but it's not really relevant discussions today because ultimately the consumer is going to make that decision. It's a discussion that we can have for a long time before it actually happens. And in that period, when the technology proves itself, when the products are gradually starting to become accepted, I think it's an inevitable change towards replacement. But again, it's not a debate that's useful today because it only polarizes the situation and it's not going to change anything. We're not going to be able to replace half of the meat demand 5 years from today. That's not going to happen. That's simply way, way, way too much. So it's going to be gradual anyway.
Despite we could assume that the main opposition would come from the traditional meat industry, Mr. Westreit points out the industry is aware a change needs to be made. However, does the public welcome culture meat? The technology is subject to debate among people who seem to be divided in considering natural.
Yeah, there are counter forces. We do see them. But generally speaking, the industry considers this to be something that can coexist. Actually, several large meat producers are investing in this technology. One of our main investors actually is a pretty huge European meat processor, for instance. The biggest opposition kind of activities come from organizations that represent sectors. So if you take, for instance, the Cattlemen's Association in the US, and I think there's an Australian version of that as well. One exception is not so much economically driven, but is more quite some resistance from a cultural point of view. It's like, this isn't food. I mean, food isn't supposed to be made this way. There have been many surveys asking people what their position is towards this technology. But you need to look at them from a certain angle because the product is not available yet. So it's always hard to ask people about something that doesn't exist yet. There was one in Florida where people were asked, would you try this product when it comes to the market? Would you consider this to be a potential solution to all sorts of problems? And on the other hand, do you consider this to be a natural product? The outcome was that 50-60%, I think, of consumers would give this a try. And at the same time, overwhelmingly, the answer to the question, do you think it's natural, was no.
After explaining briefly the process that Musa Meat uses, Mr. Westreit argued that this product could become more transparent and ethical than traditional one.
It's common practice to add serum, which is basically blood. The serum contains a lot of molecules that could say make the cells feel as if they are in the animal. We are not going to use serum with any product that's going to go to the market because it's a very animal unfriendly product. We've replaced that with non-animal alternatives. We're mimicking what happens in the animal as good as we can. We just do it outside of the animal. I would have to add to that we are a non-GMO companies, but other companies in the field do use genetically modified cells. Now that's where you might at least mentally cross a barrier where this is not natural anymore. And ultimately, despite the fact that it's perceived as unnatural by many, the paradox, I think at least, is that we can actually turn this into an industry that is more transparent than the current meat industry. Yeah, and definitely more ethical. Yeah.
Although the technology is not mature enough to cover the global demand and replace traditional meat production, there are companies that are already launching their product on the market. One of these is Vow, based in Sydney, and the CSO, Dr. James Ryle, has expressed his enthusiasm by saying that the company will launch its first product in Singapore by Christmas 2022. Dr. Ryle explains the process of making cultured meat is the same process that would normally happen inside the animal, bringing many benefits to the environment, health, and ethic.
We've publicly announced that we plan to have product on consumer plates by Christmas this year. We take a very small biopsy, about the size of the tip of your little finger. And from there, we're able to isolate the different cell types that we're interested in working with. So those cell types, they might be muscle stem cells. Once we've done that isolation process, we then take those cells and grow them up to huge numbers, around about 200 vials of cells. And then we can take one of those vials and expand that up to be another 200 or 300 vials of that then go into our seed train to feed our big 200-litre and 2,000-litre bioreactors. So we can run this process again and again and again and again to produce huge amounts of cultured food at the other end. We move it into a small-scale culture. We give ourselves a lot of sugar and essential amino acids and growth factors and other things that they would normally get when they exist inside the animal. Once our cells have grown up enough, we move away from small-scale cultures and we move into 100-litre and thousands of litres of culture. From there, we grow up massive numbers of cells. We're talking hundreds of billions and trillions of cells over a period of a week or so. And then we can harvest our cells. So the process doesn't stop there. We take that that cell paste and we bring it into our kitchen where our incredible chef converts that cell paste into something that consumers want to eat. And so what we're left with at the end is this incredible product that has been produced in a way that has not harmed any animals along the way.
Dr. Ryle says that Vow is committed to sustainability goals, not just with its product, but also with its operations.
I think the environmental stuff is absolutely true and very, very exciting. That the core thing here is about the ability for us to use renewable energy as our input energy source for a lot of what we're doing. The other really interesting thing is that we can stop using antibiotics. If we're using stainless steel and sterile enclosed systems, we can take a lot of the global antibiotic use in agriculture out of the system as well. And then because we're now producing meat without the animal, the ethical side of what we're making is now really exciting as well.
If you want to know more about Culture Meat, visit cellularagricultureaustralia.com.au. I am Manolo Iachizzi. Stay cool.
That was Iachizzi Manolo with an exploration into cellular food production.
Unfortunately, that concludes our show for today. Tune in on Tuesday and Thursday afternoons for more news from student journalists at Griffith University. My name is Amela.
And my name is Kian. Thank you for listening and remember, stay green.
You're listening to
Source News
on 4EB Community Radio, presented by Griffith University students.